Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture on the Easter Rising in 1916 with Roy Foster, Carroll Professor of Irish History at Oxford University. Tonight's lecture is presented by the Boston University Center for the Humanities, the Institute for the Study of Irish Culture, and the Center for Interdisciplinary Teaching and Learning in the College of General Studies. We begin with an introduction by Professor John Mackey, Senior Lecturer of Social Sciences at Boston University.
It's a great pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished speaker, Professor Roy Foster. Roy holds an endowed chair at Oxford University as Carroll Professor of Irish History at Hartford College. He was previously Professor of Modern British History at Birkbeck College, University of London, and has held visiting fellowships at St. Anthony's College, Oxford, and the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. He's a fellow of the British Academy, the Royal Historical Society, and the Royal Society of Literature, and an honorary member of the Royal Irish Academy. In addition, Roy's been granted honorary degrees from prestigious universities on both sides of the Atlantic, and he's universally regarded as one of the most influential scholars of modern Irish history and culture. His award-winning publications are too numerous to mention in full, but include Modern Ireland, 1600 to 1972, which has become a standard in the field. His analysis of Irish myth-making, titled The Irish Story, Telling Tales and Making It Up in Ireland, which I found particularly fascinating, and the authorized two-volume biography of William Butler Yeats. His most recent work is Vivid Faces, The Revolutionary Generation in Ireland, which examines the fascinating lives of a series of individuals who forged a generational shift from parliamentary home rule politics to radicalism and revolution on the eve of the Easter Rising and the Anglo-Irish War. Roy Foster has played a leading role in the development of modern Irish historiography and has helped shape our understanding of modern Irish culture in significant ways. The depth of his analysis and his efforts to understand not just the actions, but the feelings of his historical subjects, along with the impressive scope of his archival work, partly explain Roy's contributions as a critic and historian. But he is also an unusually gifted and elegant writer. On the occasion of the death of Irish poet Seamus Heaney 2 years ago, Roy wrote a remembrance in The Guardian. I'd like to read the opening paragraph of this piece, which I think illustrates marvelously Roy's graceful prose. My first thought on hearing the immeasurably sad news of Seamus Heaney's death was a sensation of a great tree having fallen, that sense of empty space, desolation, uprooting. Heaney's place in Irish culture, not just in Irish poetry, was often compared to that of W.B. Yeats, particularly after he followed Yeats in the winning of the Nobel Prize in 1995. He possessed what he himself ascribed to Yeats, quote, the gift of establishing authority within a culture, unquote. But whereas Yeats's shadow was seen by some of his younger contemporaries, at least, as blotting out the sun and stunting the growth of the forest, Heaney's great presence let in the light. A beautifully written piece remembering Seamus Heaney. It's my great pleasure to introduce the author of Vivid Faces, Revolutionary Generation in Ireland, Professor Roy Foster.
Thanks so much, John, for that very eloquent and too generous introduction. It's lovely to hear Seamus invoked in this place, which he knew well. Yeats wrote his great poetic sequence about violence and the collapse of civilization in 1921. But he called it 1919. And though people think of that poem as being about the Irish Revolution, he originally called it Thoughts on the Present State of the World. And Ireland is and was part of the world. And the seismic events that overtook Irish history and Irish life and Irish people in those years were also echoed elsewhere all over Europe. That poem is as much about Russia, in my view, as about Ireland. And the people I've been dealing with in my recent work, which John and Meg kindly mentioned, are, I think, very parallel in their lives and in their preoccupations to many young people all over Europe in the same era. And many of them had connections, in fact, with revolutionaries in other countries. So the Irish Revolution is part of a Europe in turmoil. It's paralleled elsewhere, as often when a guerrilla war of independence is succeeded by a brutal civil war between ex-comrades. But one of the things that people look for after a time of upheaval is continuity. And that great, other great Irishman, Edmund Burke, doesn't appear enough on lists of greatest Irishmen, as far as I'm concerned. Burke reflected on this when he wrote in his reflections on the French Revolution that what people want after a revolution is to believe that they now live in a society which is an inheritance from their forefathers. He's relating it to the Glorious Revolution. He's relating it to the France that is, in his view, destroyed by the French Revolution. But reading this recently, I thought it was a good phrase to take for the way that we live with the inheritance of the Irish Revolution. Because the state that emerged from the events of Easter 1916, 100 years ago, and its aftermath, is indeed seen as an inheritance from those forefathers. But the theme of inheritance, the concept of inheritance, carries a certain baggage, a baggage of contested entitlement, a baggage of arguments about legitimate descent, rows about property and the intentions of the dead, senses of exclusion, resentment of one's siblings and peers, and all the simmering self-righteousness of family quarrels. Coleridge said that Burke's greatness lay in his ability to read history philosophically, but in Ireland I think we read it emotionally. And where the emotions meet the philosophies is, I think, where a very interesting confluence takes place, bound up in how we remember things. And memory is, of course, the theme of many historians. Nowadays, following a fashion set like all the best fashions in France, and it sometimes seems that even in academe now, where, and I know there are many people here tonight who study memory or are involved in projects about memory, we seem to find memory a more rewarding concept than history, and the idea of memory more apprehensible than some hopeless Rankian quest to find out what actually happened. As Pierre Nora, the doyen of memory studies, put it, memory is life born by living societies founded in its name. It remains in permanent evolution, open to the dialectic of remembering and forgetting. History, on the other hand, history is the reconstruction, always problematic and incomplete, of what is no longer. And so there's been a tendency over the last decades to choose, so to speak, life rather than history. It's more involving, it's more touchy-feely, it's easier sometimes than mining for hard, reconstructive quasi-facts. And memory itself is a protean subject. It's been subdivided into social memory, cultural memory, reconciliatory memory, healing memory, often brought into the concept of bringing fractured societies together through the idea of arriving at a truth which will salve all wounds and perhaps all consciences. This can, I think, elide rather easily into subdividing truth itself into different kinds, which is a pretty slippery slope. So let's stick with memory. And I'd like to posit a few other definitions, kinds of memory tonight, perhaps mutually exclusive memory or amnesiac memory or combative memory. Those are the kind of memories I associate with Irish history, which is my theme tonight. And I think they might reflect better the reality of a country where, as W.B. Yeats put it, no people hate as we do, in whom the past is always alive. Yeats, at least when he looked like that and was fiercely engaged in politics, was rather proud of the Irish propensity for hatred. Later, he repudiated it, telling a friend that nothing great could come from hatred and violence, though actually much of his poetry, I think, contradicts that. And hatred isn't normally part of the kind of historical memory which we prospect, but it is part of the motor that drives revolutions, and it plays its part in the radicalization process that energizes a revolutionary generation. Some recent work on the Irish Revolution of 1912 to 22 has reintroduced this controversial concept, emphasizing conflict within the revolutionary movement rather than simply its opposition to the British state. And the way that this affected relations between communities in rural Ireland, as well as between Republicans and the voices of the British Crown, even though that simpler, that more straightforward conflict may have been supplying the rationale for activities that were perhaps stemming from more atavistic feelings and more ancient quarrels than a religious war, a righteous war of liberation against a foreign oppressor. I leave that particular controversy there, but it supplies one example of the sensitivities involved in remembering what might have happened 100 years ago. And with the centenary of the revolution upon us, and indeed an entire decade of centenaries, I think we're much concerned with memory, and even for the purposes of dramatic and popular entertainment, its recreation as a kind of costume drama pastiche. O'Connell Street was filled with people in such garb last Easter Monday as part of the Road to the Rising celebrations. But there are more searching issues to be prospected as well, raising parallels and paradoxes both past and present. Because I think the Irish pre-revolution, awkward phrase, but it's all I can use, the period before 1916, was characterized by a surge of dissatisfaction with what was being offered by the established parties. And with the rise of the Sinn Féin movement from about 1905, political and constitutional forms were being challenged. They were challenged because they could no longer accommodate a reality which was emerging. And this was reflected actually at the same time by other, by new political formations in Britain and Scotland in that same Edwardian period. It's one reason why I think an ancient book by a historian called George Dangerfield, The Strange Death of Liberal England, is still worth reading, because he works the Irish crisis substantively into a general crisis which is part psychological and part generational, as well as socioeconomic and political. And just to bring things to the present today, it seems to me that some Dangerfield of the future may look at the early 21st century in Britain, and certainly in the United Kingdom, and see a breaking down or a breaking up of outgrown forms of political and constitutional organization and a demand for change, not always coherent, not always realistic, but very much heartfelt among the young. I'm talking, of course, about the Scottish independence movement, and I think one could also bring in here the EU on the verge, the European Union on the verge of cataclysmic change. Well, in Ireland a century ago, rather similar feelings, I think, helped lead to the revolution that's now being remembered or commemorated in a way that's causing a lot of heart-searching and a lot of soul-searching and arousing many political sensitivities. So I'd like first to look at some of the unanswered, to me, questions about that revolution, the basic ones. Why did it happen when it did and how it did? Why did change happen so rapidly? And why did it turn out to be such a conservative revolution? Some of the answers might seem obvious, and they've been received into the canonical interpretation. This goes that after centuries of recurrent rebellions kept going by the Fenian flame, success came at last through a combination of dedicated activists and a cultural revival of nationalism around the turn of the century. You had radical action enabled by perseverance, partly by Ulster blocking the implementation of home rule by paramilitary action, and partly by the immediate crisis of World War I and the dilemmas that it posed for the constitutional parliamentary Home Rule Party. So that's one answer. What's the answer to the question why the country turned out so conservative afterwards? Well, that goes that the revolutionaries were committed to freedom from Britain but not to social revolution, that they came from devoutly Catholic, often rural backgrounds, which were inimical to social radicalism, or so it's been assumed. But it's been less often noted that one of the lessons of history, if not of memory, is that what the revolution turned out to be about was divisiveness and essentially factional fratricide, with the brief but deeply traumatic Civil War, that's the destruction of the forecourts during the Civil War, with the destruction of 800 years of Irish historical memory along with it, since that's where the archival records were. Divisiveness would also take a concrete form of dividing Ireland into two political entities, but left also an inheritance of divided minds and hearts. The Civil War left that memory of destructive violence between comrades, which was very hard to get over. Now, the canonical and implicitly, I think, triumphalist answers or readings of the causes and outcome of the Irish Revolution don't provide immediate answers either as to why the revolution, the outcome was so traumatic, or as to why radicalization developed exponentially in the manner it did. And in studying the revolution, I've been more and more convinced that it's essential to get back behind hindsight and try and trace the way that thought changed in people's minds and hearts and on the ground to recapture how radicalism happened and why so many people were taken by surprise. Again, to take a current example, I was listening to an interview recently with the defeated leader of the Scottish Labour Party, wiped out by the Scottish Nationalist Party, and he was asked what it was like when the tsunami of the SNP enveloped the political world north of the border, and he replied, "It was like being at a quasi-religious rock concert," adding that when you're faced with those kind of emotions, actual practical questions about the future of Scotland became irrelevant. And listening to him, I thought that that was probably exactly what it was like for contemporaries when the Sinn Féin tsunami washed over the old way of things. And the idea that there was now a new emotional force in politics which made the old home rule give and take, another Yeatsian phrase, seem irrelevant. And reading contemporary letters, reports, diaries reminds us what a surprise it was 100 years ago for so many supposedly well-informed people when the rising happened and the following tsunami washed over and wiped out the old regime. And that the conventional view of how Ireland was expressed by a speech of the Home Rule leader John Redmond, delivered at Wexford in 1915, where he asked the Irish people to be, as he put it, sensible and truthful and realise that Ireland's now a free country. We have emancipated the farmer, we've housed the agricultural labourer, we've won religious liberty, we've won free education, we've laid broad and deep the foundations of national prosperity, and finally we've won an Irish Parliament and executive responsible to it. A year later, almost to the day, the Easter Rising burst on the country like a thunderbolt, devastating Dublin and changing Irish politics utterly. How and why? And in approaching that question, I've been also rather struck by the changes in how we approach ideas of revolution, perhaps since 1989, when Eastern Europe embarked on its own seismic changes. Looking at revolutionary outcomes, we now think in terms of paradox, nuance, sometimes what doesn't change. We're more interested in questions of psychology, ethnicities, communal conflict, masculinities, and I think we're more interested in the idea of patriarchy as part of an establishment to be challenged. I think it's a view, perhaps, of revolution as a matter of temperament as much as ideology. Scholars like Lynn Hunt were writing about the French Revolution like that from the late 1780s in, I think, a fascinating way. And associated with this, the analytical idea which seemed to me to make more and more sense was that of generations. That is, the idea when a group of people see themselves as a specific generation, defined against the beliefs of their parents, and prepared to take a radical stance to put those ideas into action, even though they themselves are often from middle-class families with a stake in the system. The idea of generations as a criterion replacing, in some ways, class, was pioneered by sociologists in the years, not surprisingly, after World War I, when the whole idea of generational change was followed up by people like Karl Mannheim in Germany and Ortega y Gasset in Spain. And many of you may know this work. It's also inevitably been projected onto the history of the 1960s, where I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think it's helpful to put the Irish experience into a wider and European world framework here. When I was working on the revolutionaries of the pre-revolutionary period, I was reminded of young people in 1780s Paris who called themselves the Party of the Future, or the 1905 student revolutionaries of St. Petersburg, or again the 1960s generation in the USA and France. Less attractively, I also heard echoes of the Red Brigades, Bader-Meinhof, or so many jihadists today. And in all this, ideas about economic exploitation and immiseration seem far less important than the idea of a generation which conceives of itself as different, as entire, as ready to claim the right to extreme action and to prioritize belief over argument. And also realizing that they live in a time of flux, which is represented by their own lives and impulses, and that they're, so to speak, carrying history within themselves in conscious contradistinction to the acceptance world of their elders. And the more I read about the generation of 1916 in their own words written at the time, the more vividly they appeared to me as young, as radical, as adversarial, and often as irreverent, not in the way that we had remembered them. This rather dazzling portrait by the great William Orpen is of Grace Gifford. It's called Young Ireland, but she was his model. She was an art student when he was teaching at the art college and clearly had an eye to her. It's about 1904, 1905. We think of Grace Gifford as the tragic bride of 1916, as she is remembered in the title of one short book about her. She married her love, Joseph Mary Plunkett, in his condemned cell the night before he was executed. She then became an important radical cartoonist and agitator in the rest of her long and rather sad life. But that's her when she's young, when she's on the rise, when she's full of excitement, and when the world seems to be at her feet. And many of these people, though they often became martyrs, certainly weren't saints. And as I worked on them, the picture emerged was of another Irish revolution that's happening alongside the strictly nationalist one, and which in the end implicitly conflicts with many of the values of faith and fatherland and is overwhelmed by that older project. I'm also struck by another aspect of revolutionary history, capable, I think, of wider application than simply to Ireland. And that's the question of what it means when revolutionaries realize they've got the future wrong. In other words, that they've acted in anticipation of a future that turns out to be very different from the one they've imagined, envisaged, suffered for, and in the name of which they've inflicted suffering. Will a period of reaction, conservatism, and disillusionment inevitably follow? And tracing this in my own work has involved looking at diaries, letters, unpublished autobiographies, contemporary journalism, the great source of the Bureau of Military History, witness statements gathered by the government from the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, retrospective, still immensely valuable. And through this material, I've been trying to profile the kind of young people who made a revolution, who bonded together through politics, student societies, agitprop theatre, educational innovation, journalistic co-ops, Irish language enterprises, and also through psychological affinities, homosocial bonding, sibling relationships, and love affairs, all sustained by the hope of a radically different future that will be different both from the structures of the present British government in Ireland, but also from what they saw as the materialist, collaborationist, and unidealistic world of Irish autonomy offered by the home rulers and by their parents. And for some of these people, the Gifford sisters, Grace and her sisters, the Plunkett children, the Bartons, Muriel Murphy, Mabel McConnell, their war is a war against their parents, as well as against the British state. The cover, actually the British cover, or the UK cover of my book, is in a sense symbolic. The woman on the left, Muriel McSweeney, a firebrand revolutionary, is at a funeral in 1920. She has torn off her hat to show her shingled hair. You don't take off your hat at a funeral if you're a woman in 1920, unless you want to change things. And you don't have your hair shingled unless you're rather interested in fashion. Muriel is not, as I will later recur to, the typical Irish revolutionary as we are supposed to remember them. And over again, reading about these people and reading them in their own words, I came across this note, as in the unpublished diary of a young Cork man in 1905, where he wonders whether there's been an actual objective change of affairs, general ideas in Ireland during the past decade that makes things seem different to me now, or is it a change of ideas within myself? Both are working. I am changing, and things about me change. When I read that, I felt that prickle down the back of the neck, that you found something that absolutely echoes what you intellectually believe but need to back up from evidence. Then Muriel, again, her testimony to an American commission on Ireland in 1920, where she emphasizes that she is different from her parents, that unlike them, the younger people are Republican now. And she says, I am only characteristic of a great many who were brought up shut up at home. Alice Milligan says something rather similar. I am a prisoner of my own family. Geraldine Plunkett, another young woman from a background that's privileged, rich, upper class, and Catholic, a more common combination than is often allowed, says that when she goes to medical school in 1910, I was led away from the shabby, genteel, professional people and into the circles of young men and women up from the country. Their manners and accents were strange, but they were alive. They were the coming generation. And the whole world of Edwardian Ireland, which magnetized these people, is a world of a slate of causes and interests which bind them together and isn't just nationalism. It's suffragism, it's vegetarianism, it's secularism, it's anti-vivisectionism, and much else. The enemy is often religious patriarchy as much as British government. In this, they do remind me continually of the dissentient groups of the 1960s and 70s, which I remember, now becoming an object of research in themselves. And it also suggests the atmosphere of revived nationalism in Scotland today, right down to a strong dose of fantasy economics. And for a good few of them, the change within the personality, which Liam de Roche mentions, is to be a change in society, is to be an assault on inherited hierarchies, and sometimes an assault on religious authority too. The firm secularism of people like Rosamund Jacob, Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, Patrick McCartan, Dennis McCullough, Bulmer Hobson, P.S. O'Hegarty, very prominent revolutionaries, is very striking. Of course, there's the Fenian tradition of keeping the priest out of politics, but this is more extreme. This is a critique of the church's pretensions in other spheres as well. O'Hegarty is forever trying to explain this to his very devout friend, Terence McSweeney, who will die on hunger strike in 1920, where he says that the Catholic Church in Ireland needs reform root and branch as much as it did in the continent prior to the Reformation. We have no true religion in Ireland. Our religion is alien, not national. Most of the fellows around me are anti-clerical to a greater or lesser degree. It is only when a man leaves Ireland that he begins to see straight on some things, and this amongst them. O'Hegarty, who lives a long life, never ceases to be fiercely anti-clerical and indeed atheist. Nor does Muriel, who will marry the devout Terence but not share his beliefs. She will become a militant atheist and communist, and in her letters, many of which I've been reading, constantly refers to the Holy Roman Catholic Church. This is not the received voice of the Irish revolutionary. She remains a radical all her life. Others change with time. I don't have time to go through too many of them, but we might take Pierce Beasley. First, we meet him, if you read his endless diaries, unpublished, as a self-important and histrionic teenager in Bootle, Liverpool, pouring out his soul. Then we find him a Gaelic League organiser in Ireland, then the theatre manager of an Irish-speaking troupe. Then, if you stick with the diaries, rather unexpectedly, you find him as the seducer of a priest's sister at a summer school. In the final chapter of the book, of my book, he will crop up again as the litigious guardian of the Michael Collins cult, and he's proselytizing by then a certain view of the revolution, which is so different from all you have gathered from the milieu in which he moved as a younger man. Or you find Liam de Roche, that young Corkman, sensing that moment of change, then setting up lots of little nationalist clubs and societies in the lanes of Cork. Then we find him as a volunteer begging for rifles from Roger Casement. We are thirsting for rifles. Then we find him attending Terence McSweeney on his deathbed. And finally, I think very movingly, and these again are unpublished diaries, going through them, you find he has annotated them in the 1940s in the margins. And one of the things he notes is how intolerant he had been as a young man. Discussing vivid faces with a fellow historian of the revolution, he rather threw me by saying, are you saying that 1916 is the end of something as well as the beginning? And I suppose I am, which raises the question of disillusionment, which is a necessary part, perhaps, of revolutions. And it also raises the question of the people who are written out of history or who write themselves out or who, like Pierce Beasley, change the record. There's a fascinating study of the ways in which the great revolutionary survivor, Eamon de Valera, who dominated Irish politics from 1932 to 1959, how he imposed on his very supine official biographers his supposed childhood memories, instructing them to construct a version of his early life which would identify him firmly with the soul of rural Ireland and a warm and happy background. Now, this is completely contradicted by a terrible early life, rejected by his mother at the age of 2 and sent back to Ireland, and comprehensively rejected by her henceforth. A deeply unhappy life in a tiny cottage with unwelcoming relatives, picked on by his peers, found his way out through education by the Holy Ghost Fathers, to whom he felt he owed a debt all his life. Similarly, I suppose, if historians of the future rely on the Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams's autobiography, False Memories, and other writings about his childhood, they will be rather led astray about the idyllic Adams family relations, which have now appeared in another guise in current court cases. Not to mention the non-question of his non-membership of the IRA. But the older you live, and De Valera is a great example, the more you can control and change the way that your early history is remembered. And rhetoric very rapidly becomes reality. And the words that the revolutionaries used, like freedom and slavery, tend to conceal a complex and contested reality. They paper over that different view of Irish experience as a series of incremental freedoms, which Redmond was giving in that speech in 1915. But the Irish revolutionary generation had to stress historical victimhood and oppression as a continuous steady state, because it was impossible to admit that the obvious forms of oppression were now in the past. English dominance of Ireland around 1900 was, of course, as condescending as ever. But it was nonetheless cultural and historical rather than economic or political. Redmond wasn't far wrong. Land ownership, taxation reforms, old age pensions, creation of a solid rural bourgeoisie, the hegemony of the Irish Parliamentary Party all over Ireland, all this indicated that they'd had their revolution in the land war and that that was over. But still the revolutionaries railed against the materialist, Anglophone, uninspiring identity which they thought had been foisted on them. And that's the message we're getting from all those middle-class girls at war with their backgrounds. But they were paradoxically both alienated and empowered by British rule, especially through structures in education and journalism, which they used to undermine that very government. In the process, they'd write out of history large areas of common cultural inheritance. Speaking recently at the Irish Centre in Camden Town in London, where I live, think South Boston, rather old style, I was asked why the Irish Revolution produced such a stable state, unlike other post-war World I revolutions in Central Europe. And my answer was that this happened for the same reason that the revolution succeeded in the first place, i.e., that the revolutionaries had the good fortune to be rebelling against a liberal democratic state, unlike the dissolving empires elsewhere in Europe, who treated their revolutionaries rather differently. One outcome was that Britain's responsiveness to domestic public opinion pushed Lloyd George to terms. And another outcome was the very stability that my questioner mentioned, which arose from the fact that the new state mimicked so many of the legal, political, and cultural forms of the British government ethos and moved very quickly to an accommodating and friendly relationship with the ex-oppressor, as is very clear from a new biography of De Valera that I've been reading. And this was what enabled the cynical Arthur Balfour, in the past a Chief Secretary of Ireland as well as a Tory Prime Minister, to observe in the late 1920s, "The Ireland of today is the Ireland we made." Not a very well-received remark if it had been heard at the time. And when I produced this analysis, it wasn't very well-received in the Camden Irish Centre. And another audience member truculently remarked that all of Ireland's post-revolutionary problems arose from the fact that the country never adopted what he called a truly Gaelic form of government. Didn't ask whether this meant reversion to the Brehon laws or the institution of high kings or vigilantes and kneecapping, but it did make me think of the observation by Charles Péguy, the soldier poet, regarding revolutions, that everything begins in mysticism and ends in politics. And we've been there before. In the last part of this lecture, I want to go back to the memory of the revolution and how it was constructed. Much has been written of the way that the Catholic Church came on board in 1918 on the side of Sinn Féin and the revolutionaries. And one result was the employment of straightforward hagiography where the martyrs were concerned. They were assumed into the frieze of sainthood. The revolutionary leader Patrick Pearse's mother put it accurately when she said that the day would come when the bones of my son will be lifted as they were the bones of saints. Pearse himself had told her, "You too will be blessed because you were my mother." Now, this is in a long tradition of Irish Christological identification and martyrdom in the cause of faith and fatherland, and it profoundly affected the way that biography was written in Ireland. The traditional format of hagiography was borrowed wholesale. The Catholicism of the revolutionaries became perceived as integral to their politics, which may have been true for Pearse, and I think for De Valera, but certainly not for all of them. Simultaneously, the question of commemoration came sharply into focus from the early years of the new Irish state in the 1920s, massaged, manipulated by civil servants, claimed by politicians, furiously reacted to by old revolutionaries or their relicts, who felt sidelined and repudiated. And this, of course, is because of a contested history, the unstated but continuing conflicts of the Civil War, which raised always the central question of what was being fought, what had been fought for in the first place, and what the outcome had actually been. Those in power, mostly Fianna Fáil, De Valera's party, used commemorative activities to stress militarism, and which implies, of course, independence, independent power. This is in 1941, the 25th anniversary, as the Irish Army marches past the now iconic building of the GPO. Of course, it's during the war when Ireland is neutral, so it's giving an extra message as well. But there were less obvious demonstrations at work too. The half century of 1916, celebrated in 1966, was fairly triumphalist, as those of us who attended it may remember as schoolboys. But it was also a matter of diplomatic evasion, frantic organization and negotiation behind the scenes. Who was in, who was out, which families would sit in the front row, who was worthy of commemoration and who wasn't. The collection of personal testimonies, which were now well advanced in the Bureau of Military History, were kept firmly under wraps in case, as one civil servant said, the Civil War would break out again in every Irish village, which was probably not an inaccurate idea. And the public spectacle of flypasts and demonstrations and the endless survival of Éamon de Valera both added to the mystique and raised awkward questions. Here's de Valera in 1966, laying a wreath against the wall of Kilmainham jail where his comrades had been executed in 1916. One can only imagine what his feelings were. But this became rather sensitive and put into a different focus, really, when de Valera, first of all, used the celebrations of the rising to call for an ending of partition and a reunification of the country. You couldn't do that at the time of the 75th anniversary in 1991, given what was actually happening up in Northern Ireland. So a low-key approach was taken, covering up disagreements behind the scenes, as shown, I think, in the body language of this photograph, where Taoiseach Haughey, once a gunrunner to the provost, is greeting, if that's the word, the president, Mary Robinson, who, of course, has a history of enjoying people to recognize the unionist cause or to recognize they have a case. Well, returning to politics, it would later be claimed that the revanchism that was expressed at the time of celebrating the rising helped to galvanize unionist resistance in the north, and it threatened burgeoning liberalization in that divided province. And that's, I think, a pretty vexed question. It can't really be proven. But it is interesting that a lot of work being done on the 1960s, the early 60s in Northern Ireland now suggests that this was a moment when old molds were being broken, when certain reconciliatory steps were being taken, and that what happens in 1969 is a diversion, changes that, rather than being a slowly accumulating boil that has to be lanced. That, again, is a different subject from my lecture tonight, but it's worth thinking about. The eruption from 1969 changed everything, and the horrors that would follow entrenched the border more firmly than ever before, and had great implications for how we handle history and memory in Ireland. The one thing I would like to point out is that the faith and fatherland story of Irish liberation through a sacrificial revolution with a heroic frieze of saints and martyrs, and its assumption that there was one true church of Irish identity, that had already been powerfully queried long before the North blew up. It had been queried in academic historiography since the late 30s, as has often been commented on. And it was a young historian from an impeccably Republican background, Robin Dudley Edwards, who dared to suggest exactly 60 years ago that a necessary part of Irish national maturity must mean being able to ask whether 1916 was an unequivocally good thing, given the fact that a partitioned Ireland was one of the outcomes of the Irish Revolution. Until it is clear to the meanest intelligence that one can be a good Irishman and disagree with Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, or even with the rising of 1916, Irish unity will continue to be a vain hope. But questioning the Manichaean dualities of the received version remains largely within. It's a thing for academics, it's not for the op-ed columns, until the North blows apart at the end of the 1960s. And why are so-called revisionist and often iconoclastic approach to Irish history advances into prominence from the 70s, of course, has a great deal to do with what's going on in Northern Ireland. But I'd also like to make the point, because I was there, I was a student at the time, that we should again see a wider framework here. It's too essentialist just to see it, to see the revisioning of Irish history as arising from the North. It is also the result of work being done elsewhere. The Annaliste School in France, the new social and intellectual history prospected by a brilliant generation of American historians, the History from Below movement pioneered by History Workshop in Britain and the work of Edward Thompson and Eric Hobsbawm, all this didn't go unnoticed in Ireland. And it made us think that our own history could profit from changing the angle. Another strong influence, as I see it, though it's not as much mentioned, was a shift in Irish cultural attitudes among the young, at least, away from the obediently religious cast of mind, which had inflected, and I'd nearly say infected, the interpretation of national history. And this shift had a great deal to do with the rise of radical feminism from the early 1970s and the challenges to patriarchy that followed. Faith and fatherland had carried a strong charge of manifest destiny and the veneration of the founding fathers, but the more existentialist mentality of the 1960s preferred to investigate alternative futures, to see the past as a series of open questions. Essentialism nonetheless persisted, and the history wars of the 70s and 80s witnessed the idea of revisionism being batted around by people who had hardly heard of Marx, let alone Kautsky and Bernstein, who were the first revisionists, and certainly thought that such names were irrelevant to Irish history. What did seem relevant to the anti-revisionist mind was the fact that a cabal of intellectuals seemed to be bent on letting Britain off the hook, historically speaking. And the notion of a nuanced approach to revolutionary history was denounced, especially among Northern nationalists, as a way of, again, this concept, denying a people its inheritance. That metaphor, that image is used at different times by historians like Brendan Bradshaw, by politicians like Gerry Adams, and indeed by the future president, Mary McAleese. Arguments over revisionism were seized on by politicians and op-ed journalists, not very clarifyingly, and the importance or iniquity of revising or re-envisioning Irish history becomes tangled up in everything, school curricula, university appointments, and of course the loose canon political and intellectual career of the revisionist-in-chief, Conor Cruise O'Brien, though some felt that with a friend like that there was no need of enemies. It all looks a long time ago now, and the dust has settled, and a new catchphrase has been invented, which is post-revisionism, decried in some quarters as nationalism with footnotes, but I think it's more substantially connected with the inevitable reaction against an older generation by younger historians. In this case, however, it does mean looking again at a more traditionalist view of Irish nationalist history. This was more popular in the 1990s during the Celtic Tiger period, I think, than it is at the present moment. What didn't happen, I think, was that the airbrushed version of national history was completely restored. I think there is a sense in which Irish historians have advanced in a gingerly fashion towards common ground, where nuance is explored and sheep and goats are allowed to mingle together. This is going to be tested severely over the coming centenary years. But it seems clear that memory, with which we began, has been explored in a way that's been allowed to complicate the national narrative. And that's been helped greatly by going back to original sources, as I've mentioned, and realizing that there were other narratives and other identifications subscribed to in the Ireland of 100 years ago, notably in terms of the vast numbers of Irish people who fought and died in the First World War. Fascinating project in Boston College at the moment, which I was hearing about today, is following exactly that. So the impetus to uncomplicate the historical narrative in the interests of present political realities has, I think, been or is being currently resisted. The government committee in charge of the commemorations has been denounced, in fact, for their caution and their equivocation by those who'd prefer straightforward celebration and triumphalism. Notably, interestingly, a group representing the descendants of the original revolutionaries who seem to have taken on the aristocratic principle very, very readily. Long ago in the 30s, Yeats, who of course is no enemy to the aristocratic principle, had said that in the future having an ancestor in the General Post Office in 1916 would be as good for an Irish person as it is for an American to have someone who came over on the Mayflower. And it's proved exactly right. Poetic prescience, I suppose. But we are facing a very interesting conundrum with commemorating 1916. It's different from remembering the famine, of which there was much commemorative activity, or the 1798 rising, because those were disasters and failures, catastrophes in some ways. The 1916 rising is the foundation point of the history of the Irish state, and there's no point denying it. Those who planned it are necessarily seen as the founders of that state. That much is certain. But as I've tried to point out, there are complicating factors. For one thing, we can't tell how far the state which emerged after the treaty would have been endorsed by the signatories of the proclamation for the good reason that they were all dead. Yeats wrote in his great poem, Easter 1916, "We know their dream, enough to know they dreamed and are dead." But the heft of all the work I've been doing seems to suggest we don't know their dream, or they had a lot of dreams that we didn't really realize, and a lot of them are pretty far removed from the ethos of the Irish Free State. Some of them have come to fruition even very recently in the country as it is in many ways admirably today. So part of the commemorative process, and here I come back to unashamedly to my own work, I think must involve looking at the ideals of the revolutionaries, particularly regarding equality of opportunity, genuinely representative government, investment in social issues and cultural capital. And I think when we do look at Ireland of today and are reminded bitterly how those priorities, those very priorities, were heavily compromised by the effects of the austerity imposed by the excesses and idiocies of the boom, we might think slightly differently. And I think restoring those priorities matters more than the sensitivities of descendants of rebels or the idea, the argument, whether Prince Charles should be allowed to get in on the act or not. And I wish that some of the budget for commemoration could be appropriately used for rescuing the major cultural institutions of the state. Part of my work, my book, emphasizes that the revolution happens in colleges, in libraries, in theaters, as well as in the GPO, and sustaining such places should be part, I think, of its commemoration. I also think that historical memory, with which I began, shouldn't be swamped by vacuous official generalizations about inclusivity, which supposedly show that all is for the best in the best of all possible worlds, especially in a country which has peace walls in the north and ghost estates in the south. And to return again to my point about seeing Ireland in a wider context, how to approach and commemorate a contested past isn't just an Irish thing. I can think of very few European countries where it isn't absolutely of the essence. If you think of Germany, France, especially after the war, Greece, and above all Spain since 1975. There is an Institute for Historical Justice and Reconciliation at The Hague, which spends its time looking at these kind of processes. But you do need, I think, to embrace an intellectual and philosophical examination, as well as confronting evasions and prejudices. And I think the government approach seems determined to emphasize aspects that are more nuanced than previous commemorations have been, and to take note of countering traditions in Irish history, both home ruler and unionist. The danger, you might say, would be that this would become overly anodyne, but I don't think that will happen. Revolutions are necessary about extremism, enmity, repudiation, and what Yeats called fanaticism and hatred, not to mention terror and death. This can't be smoothed out, even by the imperatives of the tourist industry with its branding of heritage scapes, though it actually turns to something called, I believe, thanatourism, where you take people around areas of slaughter, death, and execution instead. I'd rather try and recapture in 2016 the wish of the revolutionaries to make a different world, or to make many different worlds that didn't resemble the restrictive and quasi-theocratic state that emerged in the 1920s. Stable and admirable, though it was, in many ways, it denied many people the futures they expected. European history is full of thwarted futures, especially in the traumatic upheaval that began in 1914 and arguably continued for another 30 years. The First World War doesn't end in 1918. What begins in radical idealism often ends in fratricidal violence and then in sanctimonious jargon and alienation, where, as Yeats put it, the best lack all conviction while the worst are full of a passionate intensity. Reflection that could have come from Burke, now that I think of it as well. We should also remember how easily we can let present-mindedness affect historical memory. I'm uneasily conscious I've strayed in that direction myself tonight, and perhaps it's because I'm Irish as well as a historian. But thank you for listening to me.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture on the Easter Rising in 1916 with Roy Foster, Carroll Professor of Irish History at Oxford University. Tonight's lecture was presented by the Boston University Center for the Humanities, the Institute for the Study of Irish Culture, and the Center for Interdisciplinary Teaching and Learning in the College of General Studies. Professor Foster was introduced by John Mackey, Senior Lecturer of Social Sciences at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Paul Kahlo. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.